This is for the nerds, this is for the brainiacs, this is what we deserve. Go ahead and play it back, you ain't gonna touch me. You're not gonna do nothing, you are not above me. I bet you wish you was me, I know it, I know.
Where do legends begin? Immortalized in a song? A photograph? A movie? Around here, they start in a house of thrills, on the banks of three rivers, or simply put, the most beautiful ballpark in America. They start with call-ups and final outs. They start the first time they step on the field or when they walk off. Sometimes it starts long before the curtain call. Morning, noon, or night, Monday through Sunday on any given year, a legend can be made right in front of your eyes. The legends in the making are here, in a place where we're not a crowd. We are family, where it's not just any game, it's a blackout, where the countdown to every pitch is a second closer to the start of something that legends are made of. This isn't a declaration, it's a call to arms for those that bleed black and gold. We'll see you at the ballpark. Let's go, Bucks.
Chills all over my whole body.
Oh my god, that was so beautiful. That just represents the beginning of the end, which happens in an hour and 15 minutes, and that will be the end of the Bucko season. What is popping, everybody? And welcome back to another special episode of the Only Friends Podcast. Well, you know, it's me and my only friends, which includes, but it's not limited to, my sidekick, who's wearing... I don't know. A jersey that's never going to be worn again after today. What's popping, Burke?
It's a blackout.
That's good. It is a blackout.
You don't disparage Michael Keaton. He's a goddamn Yinzer legend, okay?
Right.
People don't understand the rich history of...
Cinematic hero.
That's right. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I mean, like, we have Mr. fucking Rogers, okay? Do you have Mr. Rogers?
No.
No?
No.
Do you have Michael? We have fucking Batman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Number Batman. Two, right?
Yeah.
We have Derek Jeter.
Shut up. No one cares about the cap. He's from fucking Michigan.
Yeah, exactly.
No, you don't get shit. Mm-hmm.
Corey's got Jeter.
He's from New Jersey, I think, and then moves to Michigan.
I mean,
Kalamazoo, yeah.
Born and raised in Michigan, as far as I know.
Let's go, Bucks, baby. Let's go. It's happening. Finally, the wait is over.
I'm glad.
All the hopes and dreams are here. They'll be dashed, but, you know. For now.
I'm trying to get
we
a
have
bet down.
Hope. We have a feeling.
I'm going to bet them to make the playoffs.
A feeling.
I'm going to bet them to make the playoffs. I think that...
I like it, Burke. I like it. I'm telling you right now, I like it.
We have fucking Pittsburgh dad. Who happens to be on our set.
Oh, man.
Hey, Deb.
You think I'm not bringing out the Yinzer today? You're... wrong. Yeah. I tell you that right now.
Is every man in Pittsburgh named or married to a woman named Deb?
Yeah, sure.
That feels about right.
Hey, Deb!
Deb, you see Tom over there with the Baltimore Raven flag.
Hey, Tom!
Oh, man. Yeah, it is opening day. We're actually going to get to go to the game on Saturday.
Oh, man. How awesome is that?
I don't know.
Well, no, I mean, like, it just worked out that, like, you know, we got to catch a boat in Miami.
Yeah.
On Sunday, WPT Cruise, shout out Virgin Voyage.
That's right.
And, you know, the Pirates are in town. So we go a day early. We go to the game. So if anybody's, you know, in the area, Marlins fans.
Is it a 3-game set?
It's a 4-game set.
Okay. Are they doing the stupid thing where they open up today and then take tomorrow off?
Because they're playing in a beautiful dome.
Right.
Or where a beautiful, you know, building that has a roof. Mm-hmm. So they don't have to worry about like there being a rain out. There's already two games that have been postponed today. So like you get bad weather in March, April. So they always put a day off in between in case there's a rain out so they can, you know, play those games. But no, they don't have to worry about weather. So we're playing four games, baby.
I gotta say, I don't like opening up with the Marlins. I mean, it's better than opening up with like, well, you know, the Braves.
It is, yeah.
But
the Dodgers.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. What's the opening rotation? Keller goes today.
Keller goes today.
Who do we get to see?
I think we're going to get Perez. So the Pirates, I mean, it's like, who are you fooling? But they don't want to release who's pitching. We know, obviously, Keller today. But,
who are you fooling?
Yeah, but it looks like it's probably Perez tomorrow. World champion Perez that we got from the Rangers. And then I hope, and this it's looking this way, that Jared Jones is going to make his major league debut and start for the Pirates on Saturday, which is the day we'll be there. Here's a little history, a little quiz for you, Burke. Do you know, do you have any idea or know how long it's been since a rookie has made his major league debut? It came up with the club to start the season. When's the last time that's happened with the Pirates?
Oh, with the Pirates?
Yes.
I have an answer.
Go on.
Gerrit Cole.
No, absolutely not.
Nope.
Just pitcher or?
Anybody.
Anybody. Okay. Polanco.
No.
Then I don't know.
You have to go back to last century.
Oh, okay.
The year Landon was born, 1999. Mm. Chris Benson.
Remember he was Benson? Such a fucking bust.
Oh, he was all right.
Come on. For a while. He was a bust.
Nah, I mean, he was okay. You know.
Look at ESPN. It says that you got.
Hopefully, Jared Jones is not going to be a bust. He throws 100 miles an hour. And we're only 100? I mean, he probably could get up to 101, 102 if he really pushes it, you know. But, you know, he's getting him stretched out a little bit here, Burke.
ESPN says Jared Jones is pitching on Saturday.
They do?
Yeah.
Perfect. That's and great. That's awesome.
Perez tomorrow.
Good. Because if we had to see Bailey Falter, I just should be like, what the.
Yeah, it's Sunday.
I don't even know why he's even in the rotation, but that's our weakest spot. Like, the Pirates have done a lot of improvement, starting pitching, weakest spot. But, you know, they picked they did good by, you know, getting Michael A. Taylor, strengthening their defense. The bullpen is one of the best bullpens in the league.
So Chapman, like, baby.
So it goes hand in hand with you got a bad.
They have, like, six guys on the roster to throw 100-plus.
Right. Great.
Does it? It just seems so common these days. Like,
they were talking about how, you know, this is why we're seeing so many injuries, and should they dial it back, and should like
but dial
like,
it back? What, if you could throw 100, you throw a fucking 100.
That's like what would you do? Make it illegal to like throw
right
six as a man fingers?
As right. A man who spent his entire life trying to break 85.
Yeah,
I have to tell you that you don't take anything like there's right. No time where you're going through your head and you're like, I could probably hump up to an extra mile an hour here, right. But I'm just not gonna.
So is it in the train? Why are we seeing so many pitchers?
Fuck if I know. If I knew, I would have signed me up.
Right.
It's in the steroids.
It must be. It could be in the steroids.
No, it has to be in the mechanics.
It has to be in the mechanics.
There has to be something right, they've unlocked in the mechanics that physically that's allow people to throw too. Harder.
Right.
The average fastball has gone up by like 4 or 5 miles an hour since I was a kid. Which is a lot in they were two showing, decades.
It went up like by 1 mile an hour in like the last 5 years or something.
Yeah,
like it's they showed a chart of, you know, like
the and that's average, just the average. And, if you look at the outliers, it's really substantial. I mean, when Chapman came in throwing 105, that was just completely unheard. Although there's a lot of folklore that
good Taylor Swift album.
Sure, there's a lot of folklore that Nolan Ryan was throwing upwards of 107. But they were never able to actually accurately get him on the gun.
That's folklore. Is folklore.
I don't know.
I want to believe it. I will believe it.
He threw out the first pitch a couple years ago.
I will believe it. I want to believe it. I will believe it.
He threw out the first pitch a couple years ago. I think he's like 70. And he for sure threw that pitch harder than I could hop up to right now.
You've ever thrown in your life.
Maybe. Honestly, maybe. There are so many guys in the league who throw changeups harder than I throw my fastball. Yeah.
It's funny because it was like I see these stats where it's like if X pitcher threw like 300 strikeouts for the next 20 years, they still wouldn't catch
Nolan Ryan.
Yeah,
it was insane what that man did. Like, you want to talk about a bulldog?
In today's day and age, would that be something? Would he be an outlier? Because like I feel like
he wouldn't exist. Managers don't allow guys like that to exist. Bulldogs, from the pitching standpoint, so to speak, they're non-existent.
They monitor their innings so much now. It's like you're never going past six innings very rarely.
Yeah.
So it's just like they build the bullpens up. They
pitchers
have
used to be equivalent. Men, pitchers right? used to be the equivalent of a quarterback.
Okay.
Right? Now they're very much the equivalent of like a running back. If you're drawing parallels between the two sports, where they're a feature, but they're... See, I'm telling you, bro.
Yeah,
that was a strong guess.
That was high 70s, low 80s for mm-hmm. sure. It might even be deceptive. That might have been like 84, 85. Bro's cooking. But yeah, like now pitchers are kind of like a feature, but they're not. The game used to revolve around them. They used to be the most important player on the field.
They still are, but not
singularly.
Not singularly, right.
The position is the most important.
The pitching staff as a
correct.
Whole
yeah.
is, right.
So exactly. now it's, in the past, I mean, what the Braves did in the early 90s was, by the way, I sent you this a couple weeks ago. Did you know Greg Maddux was not on?
I saw that.
Those Braves teams in 91 and 92 when they edged out the Pirates?
Yeah, I think I knew that, but like, if you would have told me at the time, I wouldn't have remembered
it. It was
that,
Glavin, Smoltz, and Avery.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they got Maddux, you
know, Glavin and Smoltz for sure.
Just. When they got Maddux, they moved Smoltz to the closer position,
right?
Which is yeah, but like what that staff was able to do, just having three or four guys that could go out and throw nine every single time,
mm-hmm.
they didn't need a fucking
bullpen.
Maddux
was from right. Vegas, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he still lives here.
Played as well.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he still lives here. He was a goat too, in a very different way. But
they
yeah.
used to they called the he had a net like a. I think it was if you threw a complete game under 100 pitches, they called it a Maddux because he did it so many times, right? He was so efficient,
yeah.
too, which also allowed him to just go nine innings all the time. And they were going to do
right,
it,
yeah.
but like he was so efficient, and he was just like, "Oh, you threw a complete game shutout under 100 pitches. That's a Maddux."
Yeah, there's like some crazy stat about the number of people that he went 3-2 against. It's like a mind blowing stat. I think he has like, I don't know,
it was
something like 20,000 hitters faced.
It was like 40
or something.
Times out of
yeah.
like that. Yeah. That
no
he actually went,
way.
That he went to a full yeah. count. Yeah.
That's insane.
He was so efficient.
Like,
right?
I think I read the stat and I was like, I probably went to more full counts in a single game than he did in his entire career. It's really remarkable
yeah.
to have that level of control. But yeah, the entire pitching position has kind of been overhauled. And I mean, it's kind of a byproduct of there being that much more talent, right? The depth at that position is a big reason why you're seeing this massive change, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have these guys that are just throwing 100 miles an hour. In the past, like that would have just forever been a starter or a closer. That's it. That's the only position you
I'm
would
like,
play.
Wow, really? Because it seems like the Pirates are always looking for pitching depth.
That's because they fucking. That's because they sell theirs
yeah.
off.
Also, like. Now these pitchers, they're making so much money. You have to like protect your investment, right?
Right.
You got these $100 million guys. It's like you don't want them out there throwing their up, you know.
But they're
their
going to.
Up.
They're just all mechanically going to. Like it's, I don't know what the exact statistics are, but if you look at the guys that throw over a certain mile per hour, I don't know if it's 98 or if it's 100 mm-hmm. or whatever. But like when you start to cluster those guys in, like the Strasburgs,
mm-hmm.
The Coles, etc. The percentage of them that end up with Tommy Johns is mm-hmm. so ridiculously
right.
high.
And that's what they're saying. Why, like, you know, should they? Is there something they can do? Should there be something they can do? Because like the human arm is not supposed to be able to throw, you know, triple digits.
You're just not
non-stop.
Meant to throw. You're
right.
just not meant to throw.
You're not.
Period.
It's a awkward thing.
Yeah.
But like if you're throwing in the 80s or like low 90s, you're just much less likely to get injured.
I don't think that's true.
Well, I mean, the stats show how many more Tommy Johns, how many more injuries there are now since the velocity has gone up.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I think that part's fair, but it's also it's also the maturation of the medical aspect of it too. Like when I was pitching, I probably almost certainly needed Tommy Johns. Like that stuff didn't get diagnosed.
Back in my day,
maybe. Yeah.
Like I had so many ulnar problems that, you know, we were just constantly managing swelling mm-hmm. and all kinds of issues with my elbow, but I never tore anything. So as long as you didn't tear.
If you don't tear, then you're not going to get Tommy Johns.
Right, but you don't need it. But right, but like now it's so much of it is like there's so much like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like warning signs mm-hmm. or whatever, right? And kids are starting to throw so much younger,
yeah.
you know, like. We didn't start. I didn't throw
again,
my first curveball until I was
again,
like 16.
Because they're so cautious with them, right? Anytime they have any kind of discomfort or something in the elbow, they pull them out or stop or, you know, get it checked, get it looked at.
Boy, because, we didn't talk about that.
No, it was just like, oh, your elbow hurts. Ice it down and get out there the next day.
Stuck a fucking rag in your mouth. Yeah. You bit it and you fucking got out there. Mm-hmm. Like, I was talking to...
throw some dirt on it.
One of the coaches at my gym, he coaches like youth baseball, like teenage kids. I shouldn't even qualify it that way. Like, they're really talented. They're all going like D1 and shit. But we were talking about pitching. I was like, man, this is such a joke. Like, I threw 210 pitches in a game one day. He goes, the fuck you did? I go, in summer ball, I threw 10 innings.
210 pitches?
210 pitches. I wasn't coming out of that game. You would have had to fucking pulled me out by my ears. Like, there was just no... Also, we didn't have anybody else.
You guys win?
Yeah, that's we won 2-1.
That's what I was going to ask.
We won 2-1 in 10 innings. But like, I was just throwing junk the last like 3 or 4 innings.
Yeah.
But the point was, is like, I didn't think anything of it. I wasn't in any pain. I was in pain the next day.
Oh, I bet.
But there's this notion that, like, mathematically speaking, you can only do this repetitively so often. Mm-hmm. And I'm not entirely sure if that's true or not. But if it is, then it doesn't make sense, in my opinion, to try to manage it, right? Because repetition is how you get good at something. So whether you're doing it game speed or not, you're still putting in reps.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, like, maybe just the average duration of a major league pitcher's career goes down. Yeah. You know, we just don't see the Nolan Ryans anymore.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. While we're on the topic of sports, we put in a little wager last night. A little birdie flew into my ear. He said he had some sharp info. He said, we got to bet against Clark in this Houston Invitational, whatever the fuck that is in golf. I don't follow golf. I don't know anything. I don't even know who Clark is.
Just got to bet against him.
I don't know shit about shit. All I know is he said he hurt his back, and there's a good chance he's not going to make it through Sunday.
Is this insider information?
No.
No, it was public. No, it was all public. Over everywhere.
Oh, okay. Outsider information.
It was public, and I got to tell you, the books did not agree with my sharp source because he was minus 130. But I was like, okay, I'm a gambling man. This sounds fun. Let's fucking do it. So I go to log into my Circa app, and it won't let me deposit. Because I've never deposited before, and you have to connect to something. Whatever. I couldn't get any money down.
They say no.
So I go to Connor. I go, you know.
You they go, say yes.
You go place a bet. And he goes, sure. And I go, okay. I send him a screenshot of what we want. I'm like, we're fading Clark. That's it. Like, we're just fading Clark. Here it is. This is what it looks like. So he goes to Durango because it's really close. And he sends me a screenshot of like the pamphlet of the bets that are available. And I don't look that closely at it because I don't even know what the fuck we're betting, right? Like, yeah. I'm just literally, you know, regurgitating something that was told to me.
Right.
And he's like, he's off the board. And I was like, oh, he must have withdrew. Not thinking anything of it. And I was like, okay, like, no big deal. He goes, nah, I'm going to go to Circa just to double check. And I was like, okay. So he drives to Circa, and then he sends me another screenshot. And now it's Soo Yoo Kim versus Clark. Heads up, and Soo Yoo is even instead of plus 110, which was the Zaliski guy or whoever we were originally betting against Clark. And I look at it and I go, hold please. And on top of that, there was another long shot bet that we wanted to get down on. It was, what was the guy's name?
Peter Maladini.
Yeah, Maladini at like plus, he was like 725-1 to win. So we're like, well, let's throw a buck down on that and see what we do.
Like,
so I send
a shitcoin.
I send Conrad that too, and he sends it back to me. And now he's already put the bets in. So he just sends me back the betting slip. He put $6,000 down on.
Well, I was standing at the window. Like, I could have changed it then. I didn't get it yet.
Yeah. So I'm like texting, not getting a response from my side. Conrad just already has the bets in, sends me back the betting slip. We now have Soo Yoo Kim against Clark.
I have a message that's highlighting and said, okay, $6,000. I just want to go out and say.
And then now we have this other guy, whatever the fuck his name is, at plus 1100. And I'm so dumb when it comes to betting that it doesn't, like, I wouldn't ever think the line would move so far. Right. So it was like, oh, well, if we were getting him at 725-1, this must be 1100-1. Not dawning on me,
it's
like
10-1.
No,
11-1.
Yeah, we're getting him at 11-1.
Right.
So we take the bets, I send them over, and I just get a reply with, "You've got to be kidding me."
Yeah, it's so crazy, because if I knew anything about golf betting, I would have picked this up.
And I'm like, what? He's like, first of all, you just bet against Clark only on round one. So the guy that I'm trusting will not finish the 4 days. You now have him, we're now anti-sweating him as a huge favorite, by the way, on just round one. Oh, I was like, oh, that's fantastic. And he goes, and this other one, I meant to bet him for the Masters. He was 725-1 to win the Masters.
Which is still, I saw that.
Yeah, we're still going to get that one down.
And this is why you stick to poker.
That was just so funny, dude, because like, it was just like pure miscommunication and a little bit stupidness by me. Mm-hmm. Because like, I just could have read the numbers, but since I went to Durango and I got a printout and I didn't see anything, I just went into the window and I said, hey, can I have a printout? Just to see what the matchup was. And then I didn't, like, there's just different ways you can, so many different ways you can bet golf, I've realized in the last fucking 12 hours. So it was just like, oh, oopsie. So anyway, we're down a stroke right now.
Okay. Okay. So now I'm getting text messages. We have updates. I'm getting text messages that says, Zalator shit all over himself. We faded a good one.
Yes,
I know. And then he goes, Siwoo off to a good start. Oh no, Wyndham's looking totally fine. He just swung 192 miles an hour. Not even a wince. Carried it 335 yards. I think he bet on himself.
So Peter Ballantini's also in 10th right now with minus 2.
Okay.
So, you know, we might
hit a long shot.
We might have a little sweat. Yeah. But Siwoo Kim, they should be even right now. He just fucking missed the shot from the
sick fucking thing is, if we, how much did we bet on Wynn or whatever?
You know, I left the house with 10,000 and I bet fucking more than 65, or bet 65% of it on the wrong bets.
That's what I'm saying. If we hit this lucky 11-1 shot, we break even.
What?
If we hit this very lucky, oh no no no
no no no no, 55k if you win.
That's
that.
Right.
That's okay. It's 11,000-1.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
It was. I just 110-1, not 1100-1 like I thought.
Yes.
Oh.
So it was only a factor of 10, not a factor of 100. But either way, we were still
so
way
it was plus
off.
Plus 11,000.
Yes.
Not plus 1100.
Right. Which is why I made the mistake. If it was plus 1100, I would have known immediately. But plus 11,000, I was like, oh, okay. I guess we get a better price.
And it's easier to mistake a zero when
I send it over, and he goes, oh, you really thought you got the best of this one, didn't you? I was like, 11,000 is a lot.
How much you get for betting the Pirates to make the playoffs?
I didn't get it down.
Oh.
I think it's plus.
It's like
400,
425 or 450. I think
that's a steal.
They have it. They have the line.
I tried. Jeff Platt was talking shit because I asked our group if anybody wanted to go to the Marlins Pirates game, mm-hmm. and he goes, "Have fun enjoying opening day with 4,000 other fans." And I said, "I don't know why it triggered me, but I was just like,
it's not opening day."
Well, whatever. Oh my God! Don't be so fucking pedantic.
I'm saying for him, he's knowing the open days.
That's silly. And I, for whatever reason, I was just like, "Do you want to bet that they both make the playoffs?" He wasn't into it, but I would have taken 20-1 if anybody wants to take me up on that sort of action.
Gentlemen, I don't often throw the pod for a loop, so I'm going to today.
Oh boy!
I saw something that made me very happy.
Oh no!
So I need you guys to.
We're about to get demonetized.
I want you to watch before you.
You gotta knock some rust off of this whole thing, bro.
So Connor was what, 860?
And now they're going to show you. Now you're going to show yourself.
847.
847 is pretty good.
All right.
That's pretty good.
Right. Oh, shit. What?
Oh, you're still not as strong as Connor.
No. But you should fight in the UFC, I think.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is, if I find myself in a dark alley with Connor McGregor or Dustin Poirier, I got a shot.
You did. Our technique might be a little better than yours.
You've one chance.
I'm just taking guap around wherever I go. I feel very safe.
You have to ambush them.
Yeah. Who hit the 925?
Probably Francis.
Sure. Jeez. I don't know who Francis is.
No, he broke the machine. That's a big motherfucker.
Who?
Francis Ngannou?
I don't know who that is.
He was the heavyweight champ.
If you saw him in the streets, you would just turn around and
or
run.
His balls hot?
No, that's terrible.
Then I don't know who he is.
He's bigger than him.
Okay. I only know dudes whose balls are hot.
My balls is hot.
That is going to be great if that's clipped out of context. Go ahead, internet, do your thing.
Showers, Burke.
So now that sports ball is over, we can finally introduce our guest. Melissa's here to join us. Any cool crypto news? Any shit coins pumping that we should know about? Okay.
All right.
I don't know why. I always find it funny. Just
a blank screen.
The camera's off.
I just always find it funny that Nikki writes me these like fun little like one-liner intros.
Yeah.
And every time Melissa's on, it's always like Melissa, you know, kind of engage with her.
Right,
type of
thing. Mm-hmm.
It's especially funny when she doesn't come.
Oh, I'll take over the crypto thing.
Oh,
bye-bye,
sure.
FBS. SBF.
Yeah,
Sam Bankman-Fried, you gone. You out.
Rumor is he was sentenced today to 20 years of 25. Being a pirate fan.
Yeah.
Effective immediately.
I already served that sentence. That was from 1993 to 2003 or 2013.
You know what's crazy about this sentence? Ross Albright, whatever his name is, that started the Silk Road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's in for life.
He's in jail for life.
Yeah, but he was murdering. Well,
no, he was.
No, he was not.
Indirectly,
all he did was create a website.
Yes, that's what he did. Created a website
that allowed murder for hire.
It allowed anything. It was all about what you did with it.
Yeah, exactly.
He's getting blamed for other people's
right.
It allowed crimes. Anything.
You two are absolutely idiots.
Why?
Because that's not the way this works.
No. He built the fuck you platform to the government. What? I mean,
you cannot.
And now he's in jail. Correct.
Yeah. You can't curate a black market for murder and not be.
It wasn't for
an
murder.
Accomplice.
People did. Murder because of the website. That's not what it was intended for.
Those people were going to die anyway. Right. Like whether the money was cash or fucking on the website, they were gone anyway.
You don't understand. It's not about the transaction of money, although the fact that the site facilitated it is also what makes him a fucking accomplice. Like that's the big thing, man. Like if you think of it that way, of his site having been a storefront where the exchange of goods and cash. Takes place. Mm-hmm. It's a marketplace, right? And murder is one of
right,
the
here's
fucking.
A, here's, a, here's a better one. Snowden commented on SBF's sentencing, and he said, "Wow, that's less than Chelsea Manning got. She was the one. She was a whistleblower, and she uncovered a bunch of stuff. And you know, the government doesn't like that. Obviously, Snowden was kind of a similar case.
Sure.
She got 35 years." He only got 25.
What exactly was her crime?
I'm not familiar with the detail. Or I knew them, but I can't recall them at the moment. But I think it was.
I can't recall.
Right. Yeah. She was a whistleblower of some sort with like the government doing buying. It's similar to Snowden, I think.
But she didn't actually commit a crime.
According to the U.S. government, she did.
They're accusing that of being treason.
Something.
Yeah. Okay. Probably.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, okay. I don't know anything about it, so I can't really comment. But I think the only... I don't think his sentence is unfair. I just think it's hypocritical, right? Like, no banker served during the 2008 crash.
Right.
And they were all very complicit, especially the highest ones up, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the issue is that there's also precedence for this, right? Like, the Madoff case is going to be a pretty similar parallel to what we saw at FTX. And I think that because they can draw upon these previous examples of Enron and whatnot, just be like, okay, well, we're gonna convict him very similarly.
Yeah,
that seems relatively fair. The problem that the American public should have is that somehow like big banks and things of that nature are immune to this sort of comparison.
Of course, right?
Right. So it's like that to me is the issue. I don't know. I mean, do you guys not think that he deserves a ton of jail time for
this? I do. Yeah. No, people think he deserves more.
Yeah, no, I would be
more seems excessive.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of like from what I'm seeing on CT, it seems like they like,
white collar crime's always like interesting to me. It's like very fascinating to me in how we punish it because obviously it's never victimless, but it's one of those things where it's like a lot of harm done to, or sorry, a small amount of harm done to a large amount of people.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like death by paper cuts. You know what I mean? I'm minimizing it a bit. I'm sure there are a lot of people who just like lost their net worth, and that's obviously tragic, but it's not one of those, it's not as similar as, you know, like a war crime or murder or grand larceny where one person's being attacked.
Oh no, people have lost people. Like, I mean, it's,
I understand there will be individuals.
It's not paper cuts. I mean, people have lost millions and millions of dollars, billions.
Of course there will be people that happened to, but if you look at the whole picture, the majority of people are losing, like they're getting hurt in a recoverable way.
Yeah.
Right? Like there will be outliers, of course. There will be some people that lost almost nothing, and there will be some people that lost a lot. A
lot of outliers, though.
Right, but how much of it is retail?
I mean, it's a lot.
You think?
I mean, yeah.
You don't think a lot of it is just like, you know, people that are tax sheltering or...
I mean, I don't know. What do you consider a lot?
Yeah, I was going to say, like what $1 billion.
Like $10,000? That's a lot. And there's a lot of people.
No, I'm not talking about
had...
dollars. I'm talking about the number of people.
No, I know, but affected. Like
if 1,000 people were affected, how many of them do you think lost X percent of their net worth, where we set X as like greater than 25?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know those exact numbers.
No, obviously,
I'm
just saying, like,
do
you think it's on the high or low side? I would estimate it's on the low.
I mean, I think it's a spectrum of people that lost $25 up to people that lost millions.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Right.
But what I'm saying is that the vast majority of people are going to be below that threshold.
It's hard to tell. I mean, I don't know. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because, like, people, if it was one person that lost, you know, $1 million, that's a lot.
And it kind of, like...
Right. I think you're missing the
No, I know what you're trying to say. You're saying there's just tons of people it didn't hardly affect that much.
Yeah,
but like,
he's trying to say that basically that everybody can recover. They don't have their, like, life savings in it or something along those lines.
The only reason I'm even making that point is because I'm comparing it to other crimes.
Yeah.
It's not whether or not this is a punishable offense. Of course
it is.
But
you're saying, you're saying it's worse for... someone to like steal $1 million from one person than a person to steal $1 million from a whole bunch of people.
Yes.
But
I think that's true.
What I'm saying, he did that, but he also stole $1 million from one person.
Yeah.
So it's on top of that.
Yeah, Brian,
right?
But it's like very relative. Like
it's not.
I mean, like
it's just not. It's like he did grand larceny and he did all this other stuff.
So did Bernie Madoff.
Right. It's not like he did one or the other. He did both.
He used to kick puppies on the weekends too.
Yeah, exactly.
You kicked my dog?
Yeah. I don't know.
25 years seems pretty good.
Also, everybody at FTX is getting made whole, so that's like the other side of it,
right? Maybe I don't know. I mean, that's the rumor, but like I think also they're not getting their money in kind, which is kind of sucks, right? So if you just had like a bunch of Bitcoin on there and then, you know, now you just get back the dollar value that it was worth after FTX collapsed.
Yeah, of course.
Which is like, you know, a fraction of what your actual asset is worth now.
Do you guys remember the Enron thing?
It
could have
went the other way.
Did those people get made whole?
Who?
No.
Enron?
I don't believe so.
I'm not sure.
I don't think they were bailed out.
Probably not.
Yeah. Generally, this stuff doesn't get bailed out. I'm not sure what about FTX is different.
I think they had a ton of assets still that they were able to liquidate to give back to the customers.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had a lot of Solana and they had a lot of, you know, Bitcoin still.
Yeah. I mean, the framework that I was trying to create a conversation over that clearly didn't work is the way the judicial system works and why white collar crime is interesting to me, because it's not the same as violent crime. It's not the same as targeted crime. And moreover, like, we see a ton of fraud take place day over day where it is it becomes punishable like this at scale, but it very rarely happens whenever it's just directed, right? Like, look how many scams there are where people are just, you know, targeting. There's a new one out. Fuck, I just saw it on John Oliver. It's what it's some sort of qualifier for why we get all those random texts that just say, hey.
Oh, I saw that too. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, hey, hi, Jen, it's me, or whatever.
Yeah.
Apparently, like, it's pretty wild, actually, the lens through which he demonstrated this, because it made me have empathy for the people scamming.
Yeah. There's whole farms of people.
Right. It's in like third world countries, or maybe it was out of China, which isn't third world, or maybe India. I can't recall, but basically, like, these people were getting put into, like, very awful working conditions. They're effectively, like, indentured servants of sorts.
Yeah, they're, like, getting forced to do this.
Yeah, and they're, like, farming all of these scams via text. And I don't even know, I don't even remember what the end result is or how they get it, but I almost brought this up yesterday for some reason because I think we were talking about catfishing, but they profiled a few people who got. And what ended up happening is they developed an emotional relationship with the person on the other side. Mm. And then just like the Tinder swindler, eventually like start small amounts of money until trust is built and then large amounts of money. And, you know, then they just get got. And it's an age old scam where you're just separating, you know, lonely older people from their net worth and leaving them fucked. That to me is so much more egregious because it feels so targeted, right? It feels like there's so much less protection taking place. I understand it from the more robust scale version of like an FTX because it's an exchange and it's available to everybody. So like the net, so to speak, or the fly trap is incredibly potent, right? Like you just pull in a lot of people. But I guess I do feel like there's some level of autonomy for the individual in those instances. Like you can do your own research, you can be a little bit more suspect. And that's not to say that there shouldn't be retribution and they shouldn't be made whole or in some regard or whatever. But it's like these people who get scammed, they're probably dumb and, you know, fall victim to something that they shouldn't. But also it's just like there's nobody policing this shit. You know what I mean? Like,
not at all.
FTX goes down, government gets involved immediately. There's a huge federal case.
Yeah.
They're going to get to the bottom of it, and they're going to do their best to make people whole. A random call center in India employs 10,000 people to go out and try to scam 100,000 Americans out of their money, and they're just like,
yeah.
It's the price of doing business.
Right.
Your boy Sid said they're selling the Bitcoin at 16K, but everybody's being made whole.
Wait, they're selling it to who?
I don't know that part.
They're what probably happened was they held it, and that's how they're able to make people whole.
Maybe
they're probably selling it at market value. And
no, because I know there's people that can like now get like Solana at like $60.
Mm.
And I don't know how it works, or like you had to apply for it or do whatever. But
they're getting their coin back, or they're getting the value of it.
Saying people that had nothing to do with FTX are able to buy.
Oh,
the Solana.
So now it's kind of like
at $60.
It's kind of like
the third of the price.
It's kind of like it's kind of like going to those like police auctions.
Yeah.
Man, when I was growing up, when you're poor, everyone wants to take you to a police auction to get a car.
I've never been to one.
Oh my god, man. I went to so many fucking auctions between like 16 and 18 looking for cars and shit. Like this is what poor people fucking do. They love the police auction. They're like, "You see that 87 Camaro? That is in pristine condition. Yeah, there's some blood in the back. A guy was murdered. I mean, we get some OxyClean in there. We can flip this bitch."
You know how many come-ups people probably had? Like, just opening up, like, some type of compartment in the car?
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
But not even just that. It's like, you know, listen, I grew up around gearheads and button nights my entire life.
What
like,
the fuck is a gearhead or a button night?
A button night.
Do you think someone's going to understand?
Everybody,
what that is?
Everybody knows what a gearhead is.
Nobody knows what a button night
no
is.
No one knows what a button night is. That's fine. A gearhead is somebody who's like a mechanic, like works on cars.
Okay, and what's a fucking button head?
It's like a tweaker only with cars and no meth.
Yeah. Imagine.
Imagine Bud Lights, or actually probably Bud Heavies. Bud Heavies and a couple monkey wrenches.
And a mullet.
Instead of, you know, 12 9-volt batteries, a little bit of meth on the side, and some Mountain Dew.
Okay. Joe Dirt.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Joe Dirt's a butt night. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Good comparison.
And yeah, it's just like you go to these police auctions, and like, man, they don't give a fuck about the cars. They're not trying to drive anything. They're trying to part these things out. That's got an IROC in it. You know what I can get on that? Oh, man. Tommy down the street's been looking for an IROC for at least 15 years. As in pristine condition. Call up Bob. Call Bob. Tell him to get the truck. Tell him to get the truck up here. We found ourselves an IROC.
Back up the truck.
It sounds rather interesting.
You're lucky you find a used Tonka truck. Speaking of Tonka. Man,
nice. That was good.
Finally one up me. I don't know what I'm going to do. He was the last, he was my last hope. He was the last one who had never won a tournament. So there was a Tonka tracker that put out a couple tweets yesterday. It was a Twitter account. Fantastic, by the way. We don't care about this one. He put one out yesterday. It said, it's been 4,363 days since Tonka cashed his first live tournament. He has yet to register a live tournament win. Currently, he's playing the 5K at the Irish Open. Only eight players remain with 134,000 the first. And wouldn't you fucking know it? Did on it. Day 4,363, my man Tonka took down a live
player. He got it done.
Bro's cooking.
He did it. He is cooking.
Fucking cooking.
Let's go.
Congratulations, Tonka.
What now?
Now go for number two.
Honestly, I don't know how he did it.
Or retire. I don't know.
I don't know how he did. I don't want to play tournaments anymore, having never won one. And it's a recreational event for me. This is all he's done.
Yeah.
For 4,363 days.
But he's done it.
Isn't it? It really like goes to show you the variance in like.
He needed to do this before.
Think about.
That is what peak male performance looks like right there.
Not a damn thing you can do about it.
He's a good player. He understands how to play poker. Right. He's very good. And.
Well, to be fair, he's won a lot of tournaments online.
Of course he has, right. But, like, you know, you curb the variance online, you play a lot more tournaments. And,
yeah.
And it's just like, then you see people just go out and, like, rip off, like, you know, three bracelets in a year. And it's just like, it's crazy to think about how the variance is.
So it took him roughly 12 years. But I imagine the vast majority of his volume was online. Mm-hmm. So I wonder how many tournaments that actually was. How many events do you think Tonka registered live before winning an event?
Probably like what?
Over or under 1,000.
20 a year.
Under.
20 a year in 3 years or 2 years we didn't have tournaments?
Not 2 years.
COVID?
Yeah, just one.
One?
Yeah. We were backfiring by that fall. No. That's not true. It was the next fall.
Yeah. Next fall. Yeah. It was 2 years, like...
I'd say under...
Real blur.
Yeah, real blur.
Under 1,000?
I think so.
Yeah.
Under or over 500? Higher or lower?
Lower.
Lower probably than 500 higher. Over 12
probably
years?
Probably higher than 500.
I wonder when he started coming to WSOP. Because that's what would be part of my answer.
Yeah. I would say higher than 500. Has to be higher than 500.
I think so, too.
Man, that's crazy to be a professional tournament player and play fewer than 1,000.
I mean, if you just play online,
in 12 years.
If you just play online all the time, like.
But if you're a professional tournament player, like, why would you just play online?
A lot of them do. A lot of them don't want to go outside.
Yeah, that's fair.
Do we know how many seconds he's got?
More than one, for sure.
Yeah,
definitely more than one.
He's come close so many times, but then just.
So he's had a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth, a sixth, a sixth, a sixth, a sixth, a sixth, seventh, eighth. A
lot of final tables.
So yeah, good amount of FTs.
No. One win. He's got that win though. That's yeah.
Finally got that W. Got a new flag.
How much was it for?
$134K.
$134.
€134.
€146K.
Yeah.
In dollars.
That's so more dollars.
All right. That's not nothing.
Yeah, like he has 58 caches on Hendon Mob. So okay. If you say he caches one in every 10 tournaments, that's 558.
Yeah. That seems so low. I mean, granted, I guess I've been playing longer, but I definitely played more than 500 events.
Yeah, I would assume so.
I would say I probably averaged.
And 1 out of 10 seems pretty low, so.
Hmm. Is it?
Yeah.
For live?
You have 122 caches. So if you cached 1 out of every 10, you'd play 1,200.
Yeah.
I wonder.
Yeah.
There he is.
That sounds about right.
Look at him.
There he is.
In the halls of the...
Look at that 1.1 million.
Horseshoe.
Best live cache. Yep.
Wow, they even got the BetMGM patch in there too.
R.I.P. That won't age well. Still waiting for that online site, guys. Anytime you want to get into the Vegas market, you just let us know. Mm-hmm. We're waiting. Oh man. All right, last thing with betting and
you have a tournament win actually. Wow. The 225 January 30th, 2006 in the Seneca World Poker Classic, Niagara Falls.
Chopped it three ways.
What about the 540 chopped no
it,
limit?
Chopped it
2008.
Ways. Chopped it 6 ways at Turner's.
What about the 25K high roller?
Chopped it 3 ways with Ike and Schindler.
Did you have no respect for yourself? A 6-way chop?
Wait a minute. What
I was
about?
Poor. I literally had $0. And I had been up for like 36 hours. I played cash that whole night, dusted my fucking roll, entered the tournament, got down to the final six, and we were like an average stack of 15 bigs. I was just like, yep, chop
wait
it up,
a minute.
Baby.
What about the 25K No Limit Hold'em Week 2 Voices Carry event number 1 at Poker After Dark?
Six-handed sit and go.
But you won.
But it's a sit and go.
But you won.
Yes, but it's not a tournament.
It counts on the Hendon no. Mob, though.
It's yeah, a sit and go. It shouldn't.
Not a lot of people have sit and goes on there.
And we did a saver with Nick. Not that that matters, but... We still played it out.
What about the Arizona tournament?
That's the one I won.
You went.
But it's not on Hendon Mob.
It doesn't count.
It was such a down. It was such a down bad tournament.
You got like that little bracelet thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought it was like in that desk.
It is in this desk.
Yeah. Show the people what you want. What did he win? Show the people what you want.
Somebody stole it.
No, it's gone.
Gone forever.
No.
Wait, where did you see how many caches somebody has?
Results.
There it is. Look at that. Whoa, Berkey.
It's basically a WSOP bracelet.
That's what they wanted you to think.
Yep. Paradise Casino. This is 2007.
So you did win something.
I mean, it's not on Hendon Mob, so it doesn't count.
Sure.
I might start wearing this.
You should lobby to get it on Hendon Mob.
Not wear it. Yeah, put it on.
No. Let's go.
Kev Mass, can you please?
Matches your shirt. I mean, black and gold, baby.
I was so fucking happy when I won this. You guys have no idea. LaManna knows because...
2007, I was 9.
Well,
I was 8.
At the end of 2006, I, in a blind fury one night, dusted 80% of my 60K bankroll playing... PLO. I started off
four
playing
four tables of 2550.
Yeah, I started off playing one table heads up 2-4. I got stuck and then I just kept rising through the ranks until I was playing three tables on full tilt and three tables on stars simultaneously of 2550.
Greg and I are just shaking our heads like this fucking idiot.
So we dusted all that and then I panicked and I felt like I needed to do something important. So I paid off one of my student loans for 6K, leaving myself with like $10,000. So I like 65, 70,000 or whatever. I dust all the way down to 16K and then I go, oh,
time to pay student loan.
I should do something. I just send 6K to my student loan.
Yeah.
So I went to Arizona with 10K and a dream of making it as a somewhat pro baseball player, which by the way, there were a few guys who came out of that camp that did have really great careers. Mm-hmm. Sergio Romo. Was on my team.
Closer for the Giants.
Yeah, he was 19.
Went
to the Rays at one point.
Did he win a ring?
At least one.
Yeah.
Maybe multiple. Yeah. And Scott Richardson was a starter for the Blue Jays when they went to the World Series.
You went to this thing?
Yeah.
These people were your friends?
Yeah. Yeah, Scott Richardson is a good dude. But yeah, didn't make anything out of baseball, but there happened to be one single day that we had off, and it was my birthday, and Paradise Casino ran their very first ever no limit tournament. Guaranteed 20K to first place. $500 buy-in, $500 add-on. You could take it any time. I had literally like $6,500. Buy-in, add-on, chip it.
Literally goes coast to coast. Like gets a chip lead probably in the first level and
never
doesn't
look back.
Then relinquish it.
Did anyone go
tournament.
With you or no?
None of us are there.
No. Yeah. Not
because he was there playing baseball. We weren't. There's no reason for us to be there.
I met, what's his face there? Lance.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Met Lance there. We went to Rincon Valley afterwards. Mm-hmm. I dusted of my new 20K, which felt like infinite.
Yeah.
So now I probably had like closer to 30K to my name. I immediately just snapped dust 5K at Rincon.
Of course.
Bought a PS3, I think.
Sick.
When it came out, spent $1,000 on that.
Got to do something good with the money.
Yeah.
And this is like a microcosm for his entire career.
Yeah. And I'm also living in like this dusty ass hotel in Yuma, Arizona, like a fucking Motel 6, no safe. Everybody knows that I just won $20,000. Mm-hmm. I'm fucking rolling around town with this goddamn gold bracelet on.
I'm
just like
rolling.
Rich as fuck. Couldn't wait. Got back to Erie for the summer. And they're like, we're going to Vegas. I was like, I don't have any money. No, I ended up, I think that was one of my last losing years, actually. I think I ended up down like 14,000, which is pretty good when you start the year off fucking buried like 55K.
Yeah.
Maybe Tonka winning is now grounds for you to be able to win.
Let's hope he unlocked it.
He walked so you could run.
One time. Mm-hmm. One time, Tonka. One time. Let's do it. All right. Let's get to, let's see who's in the muck.
Oh no.
I'm like, oh no, where did it go? Mm. We are coming to you live from TCH. This is a Texas hand if it's ever been a Texas hand.
This is Texas.
This is Texas.
Texas forever.
Yep. Okay, so they're playing 5-10, and we got Ronan Traveler. He has two jacks, jack of spades, jack of hearts.
Jackaroonies.
Makes it 30. And the low jack, cut off three bets to 120, comes back around to him, and he makes it four bets to 250. You get a call. Flop comes nine of spades, three of clubs, two of clubs. He decides to go big bet, 425 into 515 or so. Met with a call. The turn is not a great card for his hand. It's a seven of clubs. But he decides to just yeet it in. Or 1,500.
1,500 to go.
And after a long tank, gets called by two kings with no club. They run it twice, and he bricks both. Yeah.
Womp womp.
Womp womp.
All right.
There's a few different things to discuss here.
Okay. First, let's start with pre. Right. Run me through the preflop action. Is this a 3-bet pot?
Yeah, 4-bet pot.
It's actually a 2-5-10 game. Okay. Not that that matters too much, but it folds to him in the low jack. He opens a 30, cut off 3 bets to 120. Back to him, he 4 bets to 250 and is met with a call.
Okay, so, that size is...
Yeah.
That size is atrocious.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't accomplish anything, right? Like, it doesn't lower the SPR enough. And it misses out on value for the top of your range, which is a bit of a problem. So, like, I don't really think we need to 4-bet here very often. I understand the desire to because Casey's in the middle and you don't really want to go 3 ways with this hand. But if we're going to 4-bet, it's going to be to stack off. We started the hand basically 150 bigs. 200. Oh, sorry, 200 bigs.
Yeah.
Jacks would be in my 4-bet range like maybe 5-10% of the time. And I suppose like with a caller in between, it may be more frequent that I'm 4-betting there, but never to this size. I don't know hand that
right,
would choose
he said,
this size.
He said in hindsight, I think this should be a flat.
Well, yeah, because he made it 250, right? Mm-hmm. So like if your only options are to click it or flat with then two jacks, you should just always flat.
Right.
But if your options are to... you know, 4-bet to an appropriate size or flat.
An appropriate size would be something more around like 4x of...
No. That's too big. Oh, but like
400, 375?
Yeah, 400 feels about right. Yeah. Then there's 800 in the pot and you're like 1,600 effective. So like 2 SPR. Pretty easy to navigate post. He's going to go broke anyway. But like now you're not that worried about the turn club and, you know, all these other things. As played, I think that we're... pretty close to the bottom of our value range. It's difficult to think that we ever have 10s. I mean, I guess for the small size, we could have 10 some of the time. We could have 9 some of the time, but not super frequently.
Mm-hmm.
So we have one of our worst pairs with no club, which is a bit problematic. That being said, I don't think we're going to be doing any checking on this type of texture in a 4-bet pot. So we're mostly going to be betting everything. I think that, you know, our options are basically going to be like quarter pot or 2E. Jax probably wants to 2E, but without a club becomes a lot more challenging to do so.
And he basically went 2E. Maybe he went, maybe not, no, not quite big enough, but close.
Yeah, not quite enough. I think it's closer to pot, but
yeah.
In any sense, I think like right hand class, wrong hand. I think you can do this with like probably all queens, all kings, and all aces. Though you'll want to like split so that you can protect your other bet size. Mm-hmm. But the point is that like queens, kings, and aces can all get value from worse. Jacks really can't.
Yeah.
Sure. So
like, maybe Kevin, like aces with the club, you just you go small.
Yeah, you can put that right into your protected range. You'll have like some ace, king, ace, queen suited in that range. And then, you know, whatever other linear hands, they're almost all probably going to fit into the small size, mm-hmm. right? Like if you have any suited connectors and stuff like that, you're probably not yeeting it off for large. So almost right. all of that's going to make up your small size. And then you're going to put like, you know, some queens, some kings, some aces, probably almost all jacks, I would think, in the small size. Though maybe like jacks with a club, you could justify going larger. Big thing here is just like what, if we zoom out, like what has him in the muck is just sizing. Right. Top to bottom, right? Mm-hmm. Like the four bet size is way too small. It's going to play better as a flat if given the opportunity.
It is like you said, it is probably a low frequency four bet. I mean, it does come in, but so like, you know.
Yeah. So when it does, you just have to choose the size that you would four bet all your hands with.
Yeah. So I don't know if he's four betting here like a lot or he just found
it. It seemed like it was a hedge to get the player in between out. But like, we don't really care about him that much.
There is no. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He called with 7-6 of spades. So it's like this is something I look for in game two when I like three bet somewhat linearly, like when I three bet squeeze somewhat linearly, because there are times to do it, especially when you're in position. I'll try to do it against people who I think will telegraph their range. So in other words, what I mean by that is when they have a relatively strong hand, they just always four bet in this formation because they don't want to go three ways. And when they have like relatively marginal hands, they just always call because they don't care about going three ways. So it's like definitely something that you can look for in these types of environments. And I think Kings plays pretty perfectly because when he four bets that small, it really is just signifying like I have a hand that doesn't want to go three ways, but isn't necessarily the top, right? Like if he has aces, he probably doesn't make it 250. Probably right. just at least he makes it 300, you know, something slightly larger. I mean, this is a pure click and just doesn't accomplish what you want it to accomplish. It's hard to get all the money in.
But people click a lot with aces because they don't want anybody to fold.
You know? Yeah, but I mean, that's not sound.
No, it's not sound. I'm just saying.
Okay, fine. Kings then. Yeah. They feel like they need more protection.
Yeah, there you go.
So I think that like just generally speaking, that could be cleaned up a lot. I'm sure Landon can kind of demonstrate a little bit more from the theory side of where this all went awry.
Yeah, four bet, you can four bet sometimes. I kind of tweaked the range mildly, not really that much, but like quarter of the time. Jackson mostly going to flat. I want to say it's like 90-something percent, but I mean, if it's in there a little bit, I just put a quarter of the time. So most of the time you're going to call, sometimes you're going to four bet. But yeah, sizing here, you're going to want to go big. Idea being that you have the overpairs that are trying to leverage their advantage and get money in versus worse ones. And sometimes you even like call it big bet jacks. And if they have like the traps or whatever, they get you. But they're not supposed to play any raises because when they do raise, they're running into it or you're folding a bunch of dusto.
Fantastic fours in there.
Yeah, for them, for the cutoff.
That's what I mean, yeah.
B-bet calls. Like they just have flush draws, they've got shots. Can't never fold a gut shot. Because sometimes a club comes and they check and you can bluff them. Sometimes the club comes and they go all in and then you just get off the hook easily when you have nothing. So and when we go for the bigger bet, like I guess we can just look and see what 2E would be. I think this is about, it's pretty close. Yeah, okay, so 2E is like roughly pot. So if we quickly look at the ranges, we can see like which is worth more, like a 67 or a 2E. So right now, the EV of the range is 2905. But now if we go back to 67, something you can do. Actually, I think you can do this with a compare feature, like this bottom one, but
I was
slow. If I go like this. There it is. Dun, dun, dun. It's giving us a little tutorial. So yeah, the difference here is 2929 versus 2905. And the previous one was the 2E strategy. So the better sizing, as per Ruse would say, or as per the Wizard AI, would be 67%.
I imagine that has to do with range construction. Like, you just don't have a lot of hands to target for value.
Yeah. You have a lot of good hands. and you're trying to say that I need protection and value with these good hands.
Mm.
And then when you have most of the time, like you have no suit, you're more, a lot more concerned about the board becoming scary.
Right.
Because when you think about the amount of overcards or clubs that come that like make you, like, it's not necessarily about the turn as a whole, but when you do get called on the flop versus 67, like four queens, four kings, four aces, and then clubs are all really bad cards for you. And those are going to appear a lot of the time. So once they continue, the opponent is going to have a lot of ace X of clubs, king X of clubs, queen X of clubs. So now your hand goes from really good to really bad. So you have to kind of be careful. But if you have the jack of clubs, you can make a flush. So
right.
If a club comes, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah. Not that it's, I'm just being a little bit nitpicky, but man, the day I see this is the four bet range construction in the wild.
Oh, this like suited ace X.
Yeah, they just don't show up.
Yeah, of course.
The king 10, king jack, king queens, like they just don't show up.
Yeah, which makes deep betting pretty sick. Anyways, yeah. I just use the theory ranges. In the
no, yeah, yeah, of course.
So bet call, no turn seven, and surprising nobody in the world, you don't want to go all in with this hand. Jacks is mostly going to want to play a small bet, and like you're still going to get some protection and value from some high card broadways that don't have a club.
Just for his thought process, he said, I know the turn, I know on the turn that if I check, the cutoff is going to jam on me and I'm going to have to fold.
That's okay.
Right. So like that's,
you
right,
also
like,
don't have to fold.
You don't have to fold. Right. If it's like someone who's like, you know, is very prone to bluffing.
And they should not jam for what it's worth.
Right.
Right.
Jam should never exist because a flush came in and you're going to be careful with your range too. Like you have ace king of clubs.
Right. But I think in like, you know, he's thinking.
Yeah, I think
like,
it's actually going to be a small bet for what it's worth.
For both people, like you just don't want to just like shovel money in because now you're funneling them to only calling you with five card hands.
I think a lot of people see like when the SPR grows to one, then they just assume that people just have one play and it's just all in because it's a pot size bet. Like they forget that these small bets can still come in.
It's like kind of a weirdish merge where like ace king, ace of clubs can still call sometimes where versus the jam. Like if we jam as low jack with jacks and sometimes he calls ace king that doesn't just pilot pre, I guess, but that's a different, who knows how much that's happening. Like I get it, but at the same time, this is the best thing you're hoping for.
You just don't get called by worse.
Yeah. The only time you ever get called is by a hand that has infinite equity and can still beat you.
Right.
Like tens with a club may call you.
But look, it's like non-existent.
Yeah.
For sure. So like when we look at the sizing strats as a whole, like the jam for out of position isn't going to happen very often, but like your jams are ace of ace X, king of clubs, because sometimes you get whatever to fold because like they have ace of clubs, king, you're chopping and you're fading a free roll, right? So that's not really thrilling. And then king 10 of clubs. So it's like this doesn't need to happen. Like I would never say, hey, jam 160 big blinds and just say, fuck it, we ball.
Fuck it, we ball.
So now when we look at the strategy, Jax is still going to want to bet, but we just want to go for the small, quote unquote, small bet for 45% because you're just trying to get the back doors that didn't materialize to fold. Still trying to get some value with Jax where you still get called by ace king with a club. You can still get called by tens that exist sometimes when we look at their range. And it's not like they call it like mega master bluff. Like you're not betting jacks here to get queens to fold. And I don't think queens is ever going to fold, but it's more so the idea that your hand's really good. You can get some ace kings to fold and that's going to be good for you as a whole. And sometimes they fold like ace five with no backdoor. And that's good for you too. Cause now they have to fold the overcard. They have to fold the gut shot and you don't have to worry about playing check, call, check, call. Because like we check and then we face a small bet, we have jacks, no club. Like that's pretty annoying for us, I imagine. And like, yeah, like jacks, no club just folds, and then jacks with the clubs, you continue. But that's not going to be a difficult one to find. It is kind of interesting that you jam jacks with a club versus a small bet as a weird bluff. You're like, oh, I'm just kidding. I had showdown and now I don't because now queens is folding. Yeah, moral of the story, nobody jams a turn on a flush completer, and I would just play my hand as a...
I actually think this is a really important takeaway that we often kind of begin to touch on and then take for granted that people understand why this is occurring in strategy. But I was talking about this with Joe in Discord today, he said it was interesting to see in real time how quickly I knew yesterday's In the Muck was a 2E. And he asked me, like, how do I derive these sizes in real time? And I said, and I think this is really critical, I have a basic sizing map that I use in all decisions, and then I just adjust accordingly based off of the texture. So in all spots, I have quarter pot, 40% pot, 75% pot, 2E3. So geosizing. And in situations like this, what we have to understand is when we start to play turns and rivers, board altering cards will cap your betting now. So on flops in like a 3 or 4 bet pot, let's say, we have a high incentive with some portion of our range to get all the money in. That's what we saw yesterday in Joe's spot, where it was like, okay, this hand wants to play for stacks. So very quickly, I'm going to understand that if I bet, I'm going
equal
to,
sizing.
Yeah, right? I'm going to choose geometric sizing because that gets my stack in the most efficiently over two streets, or at least that's the upper bound of what I can bet. And because that sizing feels about right, I think it was like potish or pot and a half, whatever. Like that feels like a pretty good sizing to choose. When we arrive at flops like this and we see that being the case where it's like, okay, Jax wants to be all in, but what hands can get all in with me?
I have a quick question, Matt. Sorry. How do you decide between 2E and 3E on the flop for you personally?
Is it two hand street or three?
Well, sort of. Right? What you start with, first of all, is like geometric sizings are just going to set your upper boundary for you. So it's going to be like basically one of the largest sizes that you're going to choose from. Now, that's not to say that you can't go greater than geo in some spots. Of course you can. But generally speaking, it's going to set the upper bound for your bet limits. So I'll look at like, in this particular instance, we have jacks on a 9-high board in a 4-bet pot. So the first thing we want to look at is like, what's the biggest possible bet that we could use? All in, right? But all in is like 3x pot. So that's too much. Okay, what's the second largest, or it's 4x pot. What's the second largest size that we could use? It would be 2E. So now we want to look at what geo2 is here. And it's like pot-ish, right? So then I'm just like, okay.
Am I wrong in thinking that my instant reaction as far as geosizing goes, because Jax needs some protection, would be go 2E?
Well, you're partially right, but you're also missing the exact point that I'm speaking to. You're jumping ahead. So the first point I want to, the first identifier you want to look for is what's the upper boundary of my bet sizing. And it's like, well, if 2E is about pot, then we recognize we're never going to play over bets here because it's not going to work out very well from a sizing scheme. And then number two, what we have to ask ourselves is how dynamic is the board? How likely is it to change over the course of two streets versus three? And the more likely it is to change, the less often we will choose geo3, right?
That's a very dynamic board.
Not very, but it's in between.
It's, yeah. Right? I mean, not relatively high, no high cards. It's
overs can fall, flush cards can fall, but no real straight cards can fall, right? Like, sure, some wheels can complete, but it's not a big enough. It's just not enough big enough portion of people's range to concern yourself. So it's like, if I have aces with the ace of clubs, 3E doesn't feel that bad, right? It doesn't really need any protection, and I can allow my opponent to quote-unquote catch up on a board texture that's going to change. But when I have jacks, no club, it feels pretty bad to try to play three streets, right? So basically now I'll understand that like the biggest bet I can make here is roughly pot, and that if I choose a geo3 size, it's probably going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of like 45% or half pot, something like that. In which case, like, you know, with two jacks, I'll basically just try to find the most simple strategy and play it with range. So it's like, okay, well, if aces don't mind going small and jacks want to go large, now what I have to go is one more layer deep and say, well, what types of hands am I actually getting action from, right? And basically what you'll arrive at is that the hands that need the most amount of protection are actually like the least incentivized to blow up the pot on this street. They'd rather defer that to the turn when equities will diverge a lot further, not because they don't want to realize their equity to the fullest and charge their opponent for drawing, but more so because they don't get action from enough hands. So like by betting large with jacks and just folding out the vast majority of the overcards, now all of a sudden there aren't very many other pairs that you can get two streets of value from. So what will happen is you'll bet large and then check. And that feels pretty uncomfortable to a lot of people, right? The whole reason I'm bringing this up, though, isn't based off of like how you're arriving at your flop strategy. We should just have a pretty defaulted strategy to 9-3 deuce in a 4-bet pot, right? It's just going to be like that roughly 2E-ish size. It's slightly smaller in this spot, but like, you know, roughly there. The real reason why I'm bringing this up is because the board texture changes on the turn. And now if you go through that same sizing scheme of like, okay, I have quarter pot, 40% pot, you know, all the way up to pot and then 2E and 3, what you should be asking yourself now is what's the new upper bound? So what is 2E now with an SPR of 1.2, 1.1, something like that? It's going to be that 45%.
It is.
So that's now the largest you can bet outside of all in, and all in should, like, when the board texture changes, you should understand all in's off the table.
Yeah.
Right?
Say that again.
So if you do, if you figure out what the upper bound of your sizing strategy is here, which is now 2E, it's going to be about 45%. And the only larger bet that you can make than that would be 1E, which is all in. But you should understand that all in's off the table when the texture has changed so dramatically. Right? We just don't shove flush completions for more than pot in a scenario where they have flushes and we just, you know, have a hand.
And if you have a flush, you don't want to shove either because what can you get called by?
Right. Most importantly, you just have a lot of hands that are drawing dead to a flush.
Yeah.
But are drawing very live to flush draws. And think about how the jam works. You're making flush draws fold and you're making flushes call.
Right.
If you check or bet small, now flush draws either call or shove.
Yeah.
In which case you're doing just fine.
When you're in these situations, you're like, oh, I want to shove here with the, my hand. I got jacks and it's a 9-high board and it's getting scary. I want to shove. But you have to think about their range and like how what kind of decisions it gives them.
Right.
If you're giving them very, very easy decisions, whether it's I'm beat or the hands that beat you just call and the hands that you beat just fold, then it's almost never a good bet.
Yeah, I think what ends up happening is you hone in on like this very small portion of range that you can get value from. So it's like, oh, well, he has ace king with a club or he has tens with a club and he has to call those hands. It's like, yeah, that's probably true. But like it's, you know, 5% of his overall range.
It's right. Just like the optimistic portion of like what good can happen versus realizing the bad. It's
right. Like or like kings, if I jam, maybe kings with no club will fold, which it just never does.
This is exactly what happened, right? So he had like he had that hand, like, well, I can get kings to fold maybe, but like he eventually just arrived at the call.
Yeah.
Even without the club. If he has the club, he snaps you.
Right. Yeah. It's like maybe mistakes occur and kings with no club do fold, but like that doesn't justify making a bad play. Mm-hmm. Like getting a positive result with one very specific hand in your range doesn't justify making a global mistake for your overall strategy.
Right.
I think that this is a really important concept to highlight is how we map our sizes street over street. And the more shallow the SPR gets, the more that geometric sizings are going to kind of set the limit for... Actually, that's true. I think that's relatively true. They're going to set the upper bound for what our biggest size will be in any one particular time. If you guys have your own in the muck that you would like to submit, please hit hashtag Discord in the chat, follow the link, or go to our Twitter page at Solve4YTV. It's the pinned tweet. I'm also going to pin it on our OnlyFriends page. I keep saying I'm going to do that, and I keep forgetting. I know why, because I can't. I can't pin someone else's tweet. It's Solve4Y's tweet.
Oh.
I'll just tweet it again.
Like, can't you just tweet it and then pin it?
Of course. Of course I could, Brian. That's why you're the manager, and I'm just the face of this whole mess.
You are the people.
I'm just the sidekick. Let's wrap with a quick crossover discussion. Shamath put out a very thoughtful tweet / LinkedIn post the other day. Yesterday? Was it yesterday? I think it was yesterday. And basically, the framework of this post, it's obviously quite long, but I think it's a good topic to discuss. The framework of this post is that essentially, he was asked what poker has taught him in regards to like how it impacts his view on business. And he said, in short, like it profoundly impacts it. Then he says some things that I strongly disagree with, that I at one point in time actually believed to be true. And I think that it actually was very true. So I think that this is probably the first point to really pull out that's worth discussing, because I think it's indicative of where people are on their learning curve. I would estimate that Chamath, I've played with him a dozen times or so, I would estimate that he's like a rank amateur. So what I mean by that is like he studies, he's a winner for sure in the games that he plays. He thinks about the game from a theoretical lens, but he's capped at the amount of time and effort that he's actually putting in. So he's maybe like halfway into his learning process, let's say, in the poker arena. And I thought this way, or I thought this to be very true when solvers first really became mainstream. And what the premise is he says, poker is fundamentally a defensive game when played at an elite level. And I couldn't disagree more with that. but I understand where he's coming from with that statement, because as you start to unlock more comprehension of the game, you start to really understand that notion of polarization and how it tends to be one range that's polarizing and then another range that's playing defense with just a slew of bluff catchers. And it's much easier to fall into the bluff catcher range than it is to fall into the polarized range. So I think as a byproduct of this, what you learn initially through studying theory is how to protect ranges, how to derive some level of balance, right? And oftentimes you forego a lot of the aggressive strategies that are available to you in order to ensure that you're not exploitable on future streets.
Like, I have a king, I bet. Instead, it's like, oh, I have a king, but he has more than me, I check.
Exactly. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that for what it's worth. I think it's just, it's very tunnel visioned and it lacks the greater perspective of what the entire game unlocked looks like. So I think this is a really great piece because Chamath is brilliant. Obviously, he's a fantastic VC businessman. He's an investor and everything of that sort. He's made wild impact in that arena. And the fact that he's studying poker deeply enough to be able to conclude a lot of these things, I think demonstrates what the process looks like to the person who is solely invested in poker. He went on to basically say that that's not to say that you can't yield enormous profits, but the way it happens is unintuitive to most. Maximum profits in poker and other defensive games, for that matter, occur when your error rate is less than your opponent's error rate.
Which is true.
Sort of. So it's true, but again, it's too binary of a way to look at it. Poker in its purest form is a multiplayer game format. So EV doesn't actually exchange at a one-to-one ratio, right? Like, you don't make an error and I immediately benefit from it. That's not actually how the system works. What happens is somebody makes an error, and then as a byproduct of that, all the remaining players are up to capitalize on said error. And their default strategies may do so already. Adjustments may be taken to maximally capitalize on it, but then there's another certain level of dependency for every player thereafter, right? Stand-up game is a great example of this. If I know that the strategy of the first player to act is to play 100% of hands in some sort of capacity, well, then my range now changes. I don't just play a normal hijack range, right? As my range adapts, so does every range behind me, mm-hmm. right? So now the EV is actually getting passed from the first player all the way through to the big blind, and everybody's taking a little sliver along the way, right? So it's not a direct thing. And the issue is that measuring errors isn't as binary as he's making it sound either. It's not as simple as you have a choice to make, and if you pick lane A, you make $1. If you pick lane B, you lose $1. That's not the way that poker or EV really functions, right? It's you have infinite lanes to choose from. They all have a varying degree of EV attached to them. Like, I can make a mistake with aces and just win less.
Yeah.
Right? That doesn't make my opponents make money. It does in the sense that they save money in some regard, but maybe not. My mistake that I make with aces could actually just be harming my overall strategy and hurting all the other hands in my range while maximizing what I earn with aces. So it's far from as black and white as it's being portrayed. And I think that that's kind of the big disconnect when you view the game through the defensive lens, right? When you're always playing defense, then this does become true, right? Because you're just sitting there on neutral, waiting for an error to occur that you can now capitalize on. And now you just reap the direct rewards of that because you're playing a 1v1 later on into the game tree when you are just carrying a range forward and saying like, okay, well, if I could play all of my hands perfectly, then the second I identify a mistake, I immediately collect that EV, right? So there's truth behind what he's saying. It's just an incomplete thought. And I think that's really important to highlight because when you simplify a complex game like this down to very binary terms like defensive or exchange of error rate, that type of stuff, I think that you miss the forest for the trees when it comes to strategic planning, right? Because now all of a sudden, what I would take away from this if I was new to the game would be, oh my God, I have to make less errors. Mm-hmm. I have to become more perfect. And this is the trap. This is what people fall into. They say, okay, well, I obviously have to go out and memorize sim outputs. And then I have to replicate them perfectly because that way I'm not making errors and I'm just inherently making money from the people who are. But it's too circular of a game for that to occur. Their errors may benefit you. Their errors may harm you a little bit. It all depends on what the other players in the hand are and how they're reacting, right?
Kind of how Lana feels about you when you like thinks you make an error and he gets punished for it. Right?
He's well-versed in ICM. He knows all about getting punished for other people's errors.
That's true.
That's another great model to exemplify, right? ICM is not a model that allows those not making the errors to directly benefit.
Right.
If the guy second in chips is making an error versus the chip leader, both he and the chip leader suffer.
Right.
Everybody else benefits.
Yeah.
Right.
Or if it's like you're sitting there and he's supposed to make the call and knock this guy out and he just knit folds it and you're like, oh my God, that just cost me so much money. Right. I'm now, not even playing the hand.
Right. Now that guy benefits and everybody else suffers.
Right.
He goes on to say, so their errors minus your errors equal your profit. Again, like I won't beat this horse to death, but that's absolutely not true. It's true. It's a sliver of what's actually happening. Yeah. Like EV calculations are really complex. It's not as simple as, how well or improperly you play a specific hand. It's all about the strategies.
And maybe he doesn't mean it as black. Maybe he's saying it's black and white, but maybe he like doesn't think it exactly that way. But when he's, you know, because
it's hard to have the greater vision and write this.
Yeah.
To be honest.
I mean,
but that's, again, this is no slight against Shamath. I think what he's saying has a lot of merit to people who are beginning and looking for a carrot on a string, so to speak, like something to drive them. Because even though I'm saying it's very dangerous for somebody to take on the mindset of like, oh no, I have to be more perfect. The end of that is I have to study more.
Right.
So at least the bare minimum outcome is like, oh, I have to be much more diligent in my studying. I can't be lazy.
If you're playing in a game with the same people over and over and over again, and there's a bunch of people, there's someone who's making a ton of errors and someone else who's not making much less errors, they're going to just win overall. They're going to benefit from that over the long haul. But it's not like he made this error in this exact hand. Now I benefit.
Right. Correct. And I mean, that's kind of small stakes in a nutshell. Like the better way to look at it, you have to look at it from a top-down approach, right? The better way to look at it is like, how does my strategy earn money versus my opposition's counter strategies and vice versa? How does my counter strategy neutralize their strategies? And when you put it that way, it's a lot more complex, right? Like, and that is poker. It needs to be understood that poker is very complex. Like, this is effectively the same level of fighting war games. There aren't any black and white answers when you're at war. You know, there's a lot of cost-benefit analysis taking place where you have to give something up to gain or vice versa. And that's the bigger point that he's trying to make here as we start to get into how he parallels this to business. He said, the simple formula forces you to learn that a lot of time, the biggest enemy of your success is you. By managing yourself in a predictable, reliable way, you give yourself time for your opponent to self-own themselves. This is true in poker, but it's even more true in business. I mean, he's speaking to patience. Okay, fine. But he's also basically saying, like, you can always just wait for a better spot, which, again, I think is like, this is all born out of the initial statement of poker's a defensive game, mm-hmm. right? No shock he plays with Helmuth a lot, but like, it's a very Helmuthian approach of I'm only going to make a bunch of small bets until I'm ripe to make a big one. And I think that that works really well in business.
It does, yeah.
Because you're doing a lot of research and discovery. Mm-hmm. But in poker, you don't bet to see where you're at. Like, you know, R&D is very different in poker. It's about maximizing the spots. You're choosing sizings based off of how much pot share you can accumulate either through folds or by getting called by worse. So it's a very, very different structural game, in my opinion, than the way businesses are set up. And to be fair, maybe I just don't understand businesses well enough. It could be true that business isn't a defensive game either. I'm going to trust that he's right on that front, though. Mm-hmm. You know, he seems to be a lot more versed than I am.
Yep.
So he does give that example. He says, as an example, suppose you have an R&D budget and you're trying to build a product. Once you have some initial product market fit, the most important thing to do is allocate your remaining resources in a thoughtful way. You should have many small bets that extend the product area. If any one of these fail, it won't be life-threatening, and you will have learned something that will reduce your future error rate. So basically, he's speaking to diversification. This isn't just in business. This is investing and everything else. And to be fair, poker does parallel quite well to a lot of these arenas, right? The difference is that when you're talking about spreading your bets out in the real world, you're talking about diversifying through a bunch of different stocks. Or if you're doing research and development in a market, you're talking about like a lot of A/B testing and trying to figure out like how the market segments and who you can specify your message towards, et cetera, right? In poker, our diversification is our range, right? It's not about putting out a bunch of small bets in different spots, right? It's about attributing different EV to every single hand in our range that is kind of like brought to fruition through the actual bet size that we chose. At the end of the day, sizing doesn't matter all that much, right? If you look at the spectrum of sizes, the largest one to the smallest one, the EV differential for your good hands isn't going to be very drastic. Where it's going to be impacted is your bluffs, right? So if you never bluff, it really doesn't fucking matter what size you pick.
Yeah.
Right? But once you start wanting to bluff, and this is the R&D or the placing many small bets, it's building out your bluff range, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why poker is not a defensive game.
Yeah.
Because you have this element of lying that extracts all of the value to your overall strategy. Now all those good hands make so much more money because all of these hands that would otherwise be losing are getting themselves to a point of break even. And that's what it truly means to diversify in poker, is to have enough hands in your range that your opponent has to guess.
Right.
And that's simply what we're talking about when we're talking about indifference. We're always just attempting to make our opponent's decisions as indifferent as possible.
Right. It goes back to the jamming the jacks, right? Like, yeah. you did not make them indifferent at all. It's just like, it's so easy just to fold the bad hands, call with the good ones.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, this statement, I think, holds true. And again, I think it speaks to the level that he's probably competing at. He says, in so many companies I've invested in and companies that I've worked for, I've seen enormous bets being made way too early and mostly out of ego. Those bets are very rarely rooted in data and mostly have eventually rolled back. So what this parallels to in poker is similar to the jacks, like a lack of knowledge, just jamming all your money in, right? So rather than taking the passive route and saying like, I don't know what to do here and my hand feels like it got worse, I'm going to check. The panic sets in and says, I don't know what to do here. My hand feels like it got worse, but there's a big pot out there that I really want to win. I'm all in, right? That's just ego. When we lack knowledge, either fear or ego is going to step in, right? So you're either going to be risk on or risk off. And one of those two things is going to take the reins and guide you the rest of the way. Neither one of them are going to be very reliable, right? Like the simple answer is just get better heuristics. And I think that like that parallel between poker and business is very true. When people don't do proper research, when people don't understand the market that they're trying to target in business, when they just believe that they have a hero product, but they have had no evidence to demonstrate that, and they just fire all in on that type of thing, very rarely does it work out. course, there will always be that one in 1,000, one in 10,000, one in 1,000,000, where it was just like, yeah, you know, I just believe that I fucking reinvented the wheel and I went all in. I sold my house. I got rid of my car. I, you know, put my kids to work and here we are and we made it, right? 99% of the time, that story ends differently. And it's the same in poker. It's like if you're just constantly having no idea what you're doing and you're rocketing big bets, like, sure, you're going to benefit somewhat from the fold equity, but oftentimes you're just going to lose all the big pots that you play. He wraps with, the second thing to understand in poker is that when you make many small bets, you can play more hands. And some of these can lead to huge pots. Some of the biggest pots I've won have been with twos and 8-6 suited, while some of the biggest pots I've lost are with aces. In business, as in poker, you have to make unconventional bets if you want to win huge pots. And the no-brainer bets are rarely the big winners and can sometimes come back to sting you. So as an investor, by keeping my bets small, I keep my errors small, while giving myself a chance to win big by doubling and tripling down at 8 times. All right, so that to me just reads as somebody who's like been very fucking fortunate to get into a lot of cheap investments and 100x, like just at a time when shit is popping. You know, everybody's a genius in a bull market.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like what that feels like to me. Again, I think that that's kind of like just a gross understanding of how poker functions. Like, no, the top is what makes you all your money. Mm-hmm. You may have lost your biggest pots with aces, and you may have won bigger pots than that with the hands that you remember being sets and straights and stuff like that. But at the end of the day,
it's like the super system narrative, right? It's like, oh, like these big hands, they always lose big pots, and then the suited connectors are the ones that...
Right, and it's true if you're in an environment where no one bluffs, mm-hmm. right? But again, like the second that you take a step out of the arena where you do view poker as being defensive, now all of a sudden your big hands make all the fucking money mm-hmm. because you're always betting. Mm-hmm. If you're always betting, do you want to have 8-6 or do you want to have aces?
Right.
You know, it's just not even remotely close. But yeah, twos and 8-6 feel a lot fucking better when you're constantly playing check call. If you're check calling with aces, of course, you aren't going to make as much money.
Right.
Right, because it's difficult for them to have worse to value bet 3 times. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, from that lens, hopefully we were able to kind of identify here like why that lens can be so threatening to your bottom line if you're taking poker seriously. But I do agree that it's a great introductory to how the system of poker works, right? Like how theory actually will function in the wild, so to speak. The issue is that he's also probably just in a game where like he's the tightest player and everybody else is spewing.
Nah, you know? He plays with Helmuth.
Well, that's true. So he's the second tightest player in the game and everyone else is spewing.
Yeah, which is probably good in that game.
Yeah, yeah. So there is, I mean, you know, this is the small stakes trap that we're constantly talking about. It's why no one wants to pay. Why everybody wants to constantly check because they want everybody else to do the heavy lifting for them and they want to be able to see three and they want to be able to make 5-card hands. But the issue is the second that you reframe the game as being an offensive game rather than a defensive one, even in theory, GTO is very offensive, right? Mm-hmm. Like when we look at these sims, you will often see that hands mix across the board, but they'll heavily skew towards the aggressive line whenever we have big advantages. You're not going to see a lot of combos that are just lighting up green whenever the majority of our range is lighting up red, right? That's very critical to understand. The only reason we're not just betting all of our fucking good hands is because we have too many hands to choose from, right? Mm-hmm. And we don't want the bottom to suffer that much. But oftentimes, just like in this defensive realm where you could start playing a lot of your hands passively, a lot of times in realms where people just aren't very good at bluff catching, you can just bet them all. You know, you can just keep your foot on the fucking gas and make them show up and be a non-believer. And God, do I love some non-believers. You guys have no idea. We're fucking getting out in these streets, man. They're asking when I'm going to play 1-3. I don't know.
Next week.
Soon. No. If I do this, I'm going to do it right. It's going to be a large... It's going to be... well organized. It's going to be a production. It's going to be all on record, and it won't be till after the World Series.
Where are you be playing 1-3 on the cruise ship next week?
No shot. Literally, what are you talking about? I'm going to play fucking 501k.
Same thing.
Yeah, same thing.
Oh yeah, same thing. Why would I go play that game with a bunch of fun players when I could go play 1-3 with Tom Wheaton? Shout out to my man Tom.
Hi, Tom.
No shade. All right, that's going to do it for us today. We got an opening game to go watch.
It's time, baby.
Siwoo Kim.
Let's go, Bucks.
How are we doing in that bet?
We just got he can't hit a fucking putt, but we're only down by 2 strokes.
Oh, that doesn't sound good,
man. No, Clark just fucked up in the last hole, so that was really nice.
Just concentrate on the Pirates. Yeah. Don't even just wait till the end.
He just can't hit a putt. It's like so tilting. I'm losing my mind over here watching.
You should go do it, Conrad.
Conrad has no money involved, but he has all the risk.
Of course.
Because he fucked the bet.
Fucked the bet. Kind of. Not 100% my fault.
All right. That's going to do it for us. We'll be back tomorrow for our final show of the week, back at noon Pacific as usual, and then we are going to be coming to you live from the cruise ship on the Virgin Voyage WPT cruise next week, all week, Monday through Friday. The whole crew is going to be there, including Nikki Limo, so be sure to tune in for that. It's going to be a fun one. Don't forget, we do have a few slots left for the final dealer school of the spring, I guess. Those dates are April what?
Not sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay. So I think it's April 2nd through the 4th. But
they're on the website.
Be sure to hit hashtag dealer or head to academy.software.io and check it out for yourself. That's going to do it. We'll see you guys all tomorrow.
Later, squad.
Go Bucks.